with us now, and thanks for your time. Business Desk's investigations editor. No, you're not. You're editor now, aren't you, Victoria? Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, it's short and sweet, the title.
Short and sweet and powerful and in charge of the world. Now, the business of aged care is a very interesting one. And, of course, we have an ageing demographic, an ageing population on the one hand that is a business opportunity. On the other, there are aspects of the business that are expensive and they argue underfunded. What's prompted you to delve into this, Victoria?
Yeah, it's fascinating because, well, to be honest, we have a new markets reporter, Gregor, who has taken an interest in retirement companies, and there's four on the NZX. So we've been looking into them quite closely, and there's been a new report out last week, which is the second report that was requested by the Labor government. But this one says there could be a shortage of almost 12,000 aged care beds by 2032. And basically this followed up from another report which had a lot of interesting figures. This is a report from February that found that 56% of aged care providers had made a loss in the year to June 30. That was the last year, a net loss. So, yeah, I mean, that's the question, isn't it? Aging population sounds like money to be made, yet no. It's the big problems with funding shortfalls and the costs of, well, the costs of everything. But of course,
what are some of the factors in that? Because what can happen, obviously, over time, depending on the facility, is that the more care someone's needs right up to hospital level care, the financials begin to alter. So could you delve in a little bit more to some of what the challenges outlined are?
Well, one of the challenges is wages, healthcare wages, right? So basically it's harder to find them. I think Australian labour law changes have meant that it's easier over there than here. And of course, we always have a tussle with Australia over labour supply. And basically, yeah, you're right. It's the fact that people live for longer but need care for longer that makes it sort of harder. I mean, there's some, I haven't seen the metrics actually, but, you know, there are some sort of freaky calculations that you can do on, you know, what makes these aged cares make money. And if they, to be honest, if they don't pass on within a certain time frame, then it makes it harder to make money.
And the cost goes up. I think just looking at your report here, something like 32,000 elderly people in aged residential care. Most are in rest homes or hospital level care.
Yeah.
5,500 are in dementia and psychogeriatric units, and that again is a proportion of the population is rising. 80,000 receiving services through Health New Zealand funded services. So there's the, you know, there's the shortfalls when it comes particularly to that higher level care and the funding of, I think, the nursing issue. When it comes to actual nursing staff, there's a disparity in wages with the hospitals as well, which has been another concern for the sector.
Yeah, absolutely. And what this does to the private sector, which has been really fascinating, and I guess where, you know, we can see those listed companies responding, they're struggling to make the numbers work. That's what analyst Odeka is saying.
I mean,
it's
one thing to sell, say, units in a residential village or even apartments in a in a facility to someone who's able-bodied and well. But once that begins to transition to needing higher and higher level care, the metrics change somewhat.
Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting thing that we've never, that a lot of analysts have speculated on, but we've never sort of been able to see, but is maybe becoming more transparent now, is how are these big companies, the Oceanas, the Ryman's and the Somersets, are they making their money through property development or are they making it through services? A lot of analysts would say it's the property development. It's the pre-aged care facilities, you know, when you're looking at these really nice luxury villages, which are apartment buildings with all the facilities and not much actual, I would say, medical care. You know, I mean, a mm-hmm. lot of them have sort of a hospital serviced part and then independent living. So a lot of these big companies are reweighting their portfolios towards that independent provision.
That is a significant move because I mean, there's often been the argument, hey, you don't need more money because you could cross-subsidise from your profitable arm to the more expensive arm. But they can also just opt not to provide the more expensive arm. It is attractive to someone to think that they might be able to move from an apartment into higher level care. I also read there's just absolutely no guarantee that the bed is going to be available for you. When you buy into a facility, there's no guarantee the higher level bed will be available for you.
Yeah, because that had been the position in the past, isn't it? You know, it's the gateway. Sort of.
But there's no guarantee there'll be enough beds.
Yeah, yeah. So this is where the crunch is really happening. And I mean, it is interesting now, of course, because we're entering this downturn, and construction costs are going sky high, and now we're wondering, are the development arms going to be even making money?
But what might happen over time is that development just decide we're doing retirement villages, we're not necessarily going to do the higher level care, and I'm not sure if there's any obligation on them to provide that higher level care, which means that responsibility will pass back to the public sector to provide and to families to provide.
Yeah, yeah. And the disparities, of course, are there. I mean, the other thing Gregor points out in one of his initial articles, in the regions, that's where you're going to have real problems, because you're not... It's not like people are going to move to these premium lifestyle blocks, apartments in the regions and then go to care there. All the flashy ones in Auckland, basically, or really, really, really nice places. So that becomes an issue for supply.
I mean, your report is saying here, you know, both Arvida and Oceania have been divesting assets which they would classify as non-care and more non-core and more care-centric. And this is the head of research at Jarden being quoted. Yeah. Ryman and Somerset, who aggregate revenues from retirement villages and aged care in their earnings. It is evident in company commentary how they're changing their approach to care, that they have been struggling to make their numbers work. So the warning here from the industry and others is that if the private sector doesn't provide this, we know the charity sector is struggling to provide it as well, who's going to care for the most needy elderly when these beds aren't available?
Yeah, that's the real problem. There was another report I was looking at last night, and they had a note in their financial statements that said, as a decent-sized aged care provider, their statement said, actually, we've got this property in Auckland, which, due to rising residential house prices, we think this is better to be classed as development land, and we've actually written down the asset on it, the chattels, the rest home on it, and it looks like they'll look to just sell that.
Goodness.
You know?
This has got real implications. I mean, it's interesting because for a long time the assumption was that the ageing demographic means this was, you know, money for jam. Yep. This is going to be this huge demand for retirement living and an endless kind of growing supply of potential tenants. But you've got to factor in the older ages and the more complex conditions that the public health sector is struggling with as well.
Yep.
And
yep.
the rational decisions that the private sector might make about the extent to which to be involved.
Yeah, the private sector is saying here, hey, incentivise us to do this or we won't.
All right. Yep. Now, what's happening? What happened at the NZX AGM that you've had your eyes on?
Yeah, so this is quite an interesting one. I tell you, Catherine, I mean, times are changing, but this is the first time I have seen an analyst get on TikTok to explain why he's protesting a vote. I mean, this is the generation that we live in. The shares he's invested is about, and these are the retail investors that I guess Eden from Black Bull Markets wanted to talk to. But anyway, so to take you back a step, at the NZX AGM, there was a resolution, Resolution 4, which was to increase the directors' fees from $564,000 to $779,000. And there were no actual changes to the board. So this is between seven of them. So basically ahead of the vote, there was this guy, Eden Bradford, you know, saying, hey, let's vote this down. You know, I mean, this is what shareholders can do. This is, you know, kind of what journalists love to see, a bit of activism. Simplicity, Sam Stubb also gave the NZX a serve. To be fair to the NZX, it had commissioned PwC reports saying that this fee approval was was necessary and sort of okay to do, and the New Zealand Shareholders Association also gave approval. So what happened at the AGM? Well, Eden Bradford was there. He gave quite an interesting account through his newsletter, and they ended up with a 25% vote against that resolution, which is meaty as, basically, because ordinarily if you get even 5% of the vote against the resolution, that's going to raise eyebrows. So yeah, the chair at the chair of the NZX said, "Hey, well, I know it's hard to ask for a pay rise, but we've done these reports and we believe it's fair." So, you know, it did go through, but that is the issue facing the NZX, the exchange itself, at the moment. People are not happy with its performance.
What were some of the specifics? Probably didn't have time to do it on the TikTok piece, but
yeah, he didn't quite have time to do it on the TikTok piece, but you'd be surprised what you can get out in about a minute and a half. So there have been grumblings for quite some time. So due to, you know, the lack of new listings and the amount of listings that just head straight to the ASX. I mean, we all remember Xero back in the day, just, no, let's go straight overseas. And the other big thing is private equity now. It's got cash and it's easier to, you know, have your company take investors privately, you know, and avoid all the disclosures. For me, you know, I actually met with a tech entrepreneur a few years ago and he said, he was quite an ambitious one, and he said, "Oh, I'm going to list on the NASDAQ or the ASX." And he said, "Oh, I'll just list on the NZX just to be patriotic, just, you know, just for the symbolism of it." And I thought, well, that's pretty sad, isn't it? I mean, the NZX say that they are, you know, innovating and trying to combat some of this criticism, but it's hard. And, you know, another one just last night, Just Water, who do the water coolers, you know, they are saying they're a very small one that used to be on the alternative exchange, a smaller exchange. They're saying the listing fees of the NZX are too high. We're going to USX, which is the unlisted, another exchange. So there is a real issue, a capital markets issue going on. And, you know, there has been a bit of government reporting on this or research into this, but it's not really been a priority. Yeah.
Look, it is an interesting one, that's for sure. And, you know, it takes a fair bit of criticism, always have had the old stock exchange. What bit of a broad question to drop on you, but, you know, at the moment, how is it being perceived? We went through that period where hardly anyone was listing and everyone was back saying, let's just merge with Australia again, and, you know, the criticism of the performance. What sort of mood has it been in? Obviously, it's wearing the same kind of vagaries that the entire economy is at the moment. But, you know, by and large, what do people have to say about it and its performance? Not good.
Yeah, just not interested in it. And even because it's not just competing against sort of other global exchanges, right? It's competing against private equity, which I think is the big story, really. It's those fewer listing requirements. And why? When we saw Wet and Forget, that, I don't know if you'd call that cleaning business, but what they do, the sprays, you know, to get your house in order. They just sold to private equity, and why wouldn't you? So the issue, I guess, where it goes next, I suppose, is where does Andrew Bailey, the new minister, the new commerce minister, come in on that? And he has said, and this was some quite interesting reporting from the NBO, actually, you know, saying actually it's the second half of the year, he's saying the equity capital markets, that's when those settings will get reviewed. It's not that clear what the levers are, but there are levers, you know, maybe listing more government bonds, or, you know, floating some sort of SOEs or other institutions, you know, like Kiwi Bank or other things. That's where maybe there could be a bit of excitement for public listings, which, you know, that's sort of like a side way for the government to sort of help with that.
Yeah. All right, and finally today, this is a precedent-setting story. The Ports of Auckland former chief executive, I think, correct, on trial?
Or yeah. This is a fascinating one, isn't it? Because Tony Gibson, CEO of the port for many years, so he's up for criminal charges resulting from the death of a worker, then 31-year-old Omar Kalati. He was crushed when a container was dropped during a night shift. So Yeah, Father Seven lost his life at work, and this is the first criminal prosecution of a... So when this legislation came in, it had this stupid jargon, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the PCBU, person conducting business something or other. So anyway, a person. But the main point is it's the person getting done for it instead of the company. The company has already sort of paid its price for this particular work safe death. So this is the first one since the legislation came in, when it came in after the Pike River mining disaster, and yeah, a lot of eyes on what the defence is, because, you know, Tony Gibson, he wasn't there when it happened. He wasn't, you know, the guy who dropped the container or anything like that. But it's because of his, because he was the boss, or because he was in charge, they're saying you should have had more oversight and you did not, you know, look after this guy properly. So that's a really, really interesting one.
Unusual, or actually precedent setting, as we said, for this case to actually come into the before the courts.
Yeah, really interesting, because as I think Phil Pennington, one of your correspondents, has been, you know, really all over. WorkSafe has not... has had issues as a regulator. So these charges are coming from Maritime New Zealand, which of course can take these sorts of cases too. This case has been sitting on around for like, I think, 6 or 7 years. It's taken a long time to get through the courts, but very unusual, because if he is convicted, the penalty is up to $400,000. And the interesting thing, because I was checking about this just yesterday, the interesting thing about it is that you can't insure yourself out of this. So he's got to pay if the up to 400K. And that's the whole point. You know what I mean? You can't, you know, subcontract or insure yourself out of criminal liability. It's not negligence, which, you know, or you know, those duties of care that, you know, the Mainsail directors were under. This is quite different, because it's, I mean, the guy's died. It's health and safety at work. It's really important. So, yeah, people will be looking at this, because, you know, if you are a chief executive of a dangerous workplace, and we have a really bad record, right? It's forestry, you know, farming, all of those industries. We know that we have a poor record when we compare ourselves with similar jurisdiction. So this guy will pay, if he is convicted, the 400K. But if you look at the scheme of things, he was paid out about 1.8 million when he left the port. So
interesting. Just reading your notes again, it looks like the argument is going to be that the Ports of Auckland is not the individual before the courts. That they're separate entities. So that's going to be a very interesting test for where responsibility lies. Of course, we also had moves to make directors more responsible. For things that go wrong in their organisations. And you mentioned WorkSafe. Yes, the criticism was it just doesn't prosecute enough. So interesting that it's another player, another organisation that's brought this one. I'm sure it'll be closely followed. Victoria, thank you very much. Victoria Young is editor at Business Desk. That's businessdesk.co.nz.